You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the International Association of Machinists, Local 778, and Teamsters Joint Council 56. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers of Local Lodge 778 in Kansas City, Missouri, represents thousands of working-class people in and around the metro. Our members work in a variety of industries, including automotive, manufacturing, freight, and logistics, and public works. We proudly support the Heartland Labor Forum as it continues to educate our friends and neighbors about the issues affecting Missouri's working class families. And Teamsters, Joint Council 56, and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, Herb Johnson led the fight against Carol Icahn at TWA, then went on to a leadership position in the Missouri AFL-CIO. On tonight's show, Herb reflects on labor leadership. Then, author Eric Blank says last year, working-class rebellions erupted in regions with Republican electorates, weak unions, and bans on public sector strikes. We'll ask him how that happened and if the upsurge continues. Now for the news.
Forum, the ILRF, announced that Costco Wholesale has responded to letters sent from them and the Fair World Project urging the retailer to make future purchase orders with the fruit company Fife's contingent on ending labor rights violations. Costco confirmed that it has not placed future orders for melons from the Fife's operations where ongoing violations occur. Fife's is an Irish multinational company owned by the Japanese conglomerate Sumitomo and is one of the largest fruit brands in the world. ILRF has targeted Fife's for its slave-like working conditions in South Honduras melon fields. Gabriela Rosaza of ILRF said, "This is a victory for the Honduran farm workers who have been organizing for 3 years and have their union rights respected. We now urge other supermarkets to have their future orders with Fife's for any produce from any country contingent on the rehiring of the Stas union members who have faced retaliation and negotiation from collective bargaining agreement in good faith with Stas." These ongoing labor rights violations, as well as public scrutiny and pressure from advocacy groups, led Fair Trade USA to revoke the Fair Trade certification of Fife's sorrel plantation in December of 2018, although Fife's continues to use fair trade certification labeling on fruit sourced from other countries. In March 2019, the Ethical Trading Initiative, ETI, terminated Fife's membership. Labor violations on the farms have also been cited in complaints on the U.S. Central America Free Trade Agreement and the International Labor Organization. Workers on Fife's plantation suffer from wage theft and exposure to toxic argon chemicals. The company has used both lockouts and bribes to pressure workers to join a company union, and there have been firings and beatings of workers.
PAI reports that the Democratic-run House Education and Labor Committee approved H.R. 397 to fix multi-employer pension plans problems. The 2618 vote on June 11th was along party lines. The Democrats were responding to pleas of workers and unions who could see their pensions go down the drain in the next 6 years. If eventually approved, the measure would help those financially ailing plans with 30-year repayable federal loans to shore up their assets and value at affordable interest rates. The loans would come from a trust fund in the Treasury Department, and plans seeking aid would have to prove the money would keep them solvent and able to provide current benefits. AFL-CIO Legislative Director Bill Samuel wrote, "Absent federal action, the retirement income security of over 1 million American workers, retirees, and pension beneficiaries across the country is in jeopardy because of the impending failure of their multi-employer pension plans. By establishing a federal loan program for troubled plans meeting certain criteria, H.R. 397 reflects the accurate recognition that allowing these plans to fail will have a devastating impact not only on individuals, but also on numerous companies and the communities in which plans participants, retirees, and beneficiaries reside." He added that it's a matter of equity. Workers left high and dry by the financier caused Great Recession a decade ago, as their pensions collapsed too, have not forgotten that Congress bailed out the bankers but didn't really help them or their pensions. Teamsters' multi-employer plan faces a financial cliff in 6 years, but two mine workers' pension funds set up and guaranteed by the government just after World War II are on the verge of going under right now. Those plans cover 83,000 unionized miners and surviving spouses. Each gets $600 to $2,200 monthly, depending on how long the miner involved toiled. If the multi-employer plans can't pick up the tab, the workers and their survivors are transferred to the PBGC, whose monthly payouts are minimal. And its multi-employer pension fund, garnered from fees levied on employers, is going broke too. Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio said, "What Washington doesn't understand is that workers sat at the negotiating table and gave up raises because they were counting on these pensions when they retired. There's plenty of Democratic support, but whether the bill will pass is up to Republicans who all voted against it in committee."
At last week's labor media lunch, union leaders reported on several local issues. First, Jeff Hayes of Communication Workers of America, Local 6360, which represents dispatchers in Independence, Missouri, said the city is trying to cancel health care for retirees over the age of 65. Currently, it pays 80% of their health costs over and above Medicare, but the city wants to move them to a basic plan. The union also is organizing 911 dispatchers in Blue Springs and fighting with Lee Summit over who will be in the bargaining unit there. Former American Federation of Government Employees, Local 1336, Union President Art Johnson said that the Social Security workers' new contract went to impasse resolution and a panel imposed a union-busting agreement on them. The Trump administration had attempted to impose an executive order cutting what's called official time, which is the time union stewards and reps get relief from their duties to investigate and argue grievances. AFGE won the reversal of the Trump order in court, but the impasse panel has undone that decision and reduced official hours by a whopping 75%, thus making it very difficult for the union to adequately represent its members. To add insult to injury, the Social Security Administration has kicked the union out of its office in the federal building. The sheet metal workers, SMART Local 2, reports that it is in contract negotiations for their Kansas City area building trades contract, which expires June 30th. They hope this year they won't have to repeat the 7-day strike they carried out 3 years ago. SMART also represents railway workers who used to be in the United Transportation Union. Greg Chastain of Local 2 said that Minnesota recently passed a 2-person crew bill, thus forestalling an attempt by the railroads there to go to 1-man crews, which the union considers to be a huge safety concern.
The HuffPost reports that Volkswagen employees in Chattanooga, Tennessee are deciding this week whether to join the United Auto Workers and start bargaining for a contract in an election that reruns one of the highest profile labor fights in years. The UAW narrowly lost a previous representation election in 2014 after Republican politicians engaged in a very heavy-handed anti-union electioneering. That vote was 712 to 626. The new election goes from Wednesday or yesterday through Friday. For years, the UAW has tried to unionize a foreign automaker's plant in the U.S. South. If the union wins, it'll represent some 1,700 additional workers in an area of the country known for its resistance and sometimes outright hostility to collective bargaining. If the UAW loses, it'll mean another string of painful and sometimes lopsided defeats for unions seeking to make inroads in the manufacturing facilities in southern states. Both the yes and no camps have been running a get-out-the-vote operations during shift changes at the Chattanooga plant. And just like in 2014, business-friendly Republican politicians in Tennessee have weighed in, with Governor Bill Lee, Senator Marsha Blackburn, and the county mayor all urging workers to vote against unionizing. Volkswagen has said publicly that it is remaining neutral during the campaign. However, the German automaker successfully petitioned to have the election delayed, and in a letter obtained by Payday Report, told employees it would prefer to have direct dialogue with its workforce. The news was read tonight by Aaron Lockman, Arianna Eckel, Chris Mann, and I'm Tom Gebkin.
Are you tired of always being told no? Do you feel you got no place to go? Then stand up and sing this song!
Hi, I'm Tom Gebkin. I'm a member of the Communication Workers of America, Local 6360. In 1964, 27% of the workers in Missouri were union members. They provided the labor bargaining power to deal with employers and a lot of political influence in Jefferson City. Unions have been in decline for many years. Today, that number stands at 8.7. In 1978, when Right to Work was defeated the first time, union density was over 20%. Tonight, we welcome a person who has been a major part of the labor movement for 5 decades. He was on the front lines fighting Right to Work in 1978, and he worked just as hard 40 years later to defeat it again. Herb Johnson has a long history with labor. He was president of the Machinist Union Lodge 1650 and served members working at the TWA overhaul base. He moved to a leadership position at the Missouri AFL-CIO, serving as treasurer from 1997 to 2012. He spent long hours walking the halls of the Capitol advocating for working people. He is currently vice president of the Alliance of Retired Americans. He was a very early member of the Right to Truth Forum, which brings labor and members of the media together to discuss issues important to the union movement. He knocks doors and makes phone calls in support of labor-friendly candidates. And he was an integral part of the effort to repeal Right to Work in 2018. Herb Johnson has been a mentor to many, and his considerable knowledge in where labor has been and great insight as to where it is going in Missouri. He has seen a lot. Herb, what are you currently up to?
Well, you talked about the Alliance for Retired Americans. I've become active in the Missouri Alliance for Retired Americans. We are currently building membership, additional membership here in the Kansas City metro area and on the western side of the state, and participated, as you referred, in the Prop A vote in 2018.
That was a major accomplishment, defeating Right to Work, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was a sensational and extremely important victory for all working people, including retirees, to win that proposition.
Now, since you were fighting Right to Work in 1978 and again 40 years later in 2018, compared the two campaigns.
Well, first of all, as you also mentioned earlier, the union density in Missouri was the fourth largest in the United States at the time. We were a manufacturing center for all sorts of manufactured products. Now, that isn't so much the case, as you also mentioned. So right away, we started with fewer union members than we did in 2018. That was a big difference. There's a big difference in media today than there was then. We were primarily knocking doors and making phone calls then, and we had a Right to Truth forum that went out and approached all sorts of different organizations in churches and schools, and anyone that would have us, we would have Right to Truth forums to let people know what the issue was actually about, a union security clause in a contract.
And in 2018, it won by a larger margin with fewer union members.
That's absolutely true. I was blown away with the results, but I have to say, our Missouri ARA made 12,000 calls to outstate Missouri in all eight congressional districts to those kinds of households of retirees that were not necessarily union members. Most, in fact, were not union members, but we made those calls out there where they were unlikely to get contacted by labor unions and other organizations working in the campaign. So I believe we reached a segment of the voting population that otherwise might not have been spoken with. And I think there's no question in our mind that 9 out of 10 favored our position of voting against Prop A, so that we would have the continued right to have union security clauses in our contracts.
With the Alliance of Retired Americans, can you talk about that? Are they in the big cities or all around the whole state of Missouri?
The ARA, the Alliance of Retired Americans, is in 39 of the 450 states. In fact, we're trying to organize one in the state of Kansas right now. Missouri was the fourth chartered state. We were the number four state chartered in the Alliance of Retired Americans. The Alliance of Retired Americans had been called the National Council of Senior Citizens for many years, a labor organization of retired union members. In 2001, the charter was changed, a new constitution was written, it became the Alliance for Retired Americans. It also embodied or included members of the society out here that are not necessarily have ever been in unions, who want to belong to an organization to represent our needs in the senior citizens community.
To work to protect items that are important to the seniors.
Absolutely. The primary purpose is to preserve and protect and to enhance Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and all the programs that are under those programs.
Could you discuss how you got interested in the labor movement?
Well, I went to work for TWA in 1964, and 2 years later, there was a great airline strike of some five airlines, including TWA, and we were expected to walk the picket line in order to get strike benefits. And as a young person at 21 years of age with some young children, I needed every dime I could get, and so I showed up on the picket line. I believe it was down at Old Municipal Airport the first time I walked picket. And I noticed one thing right there from the old people that were probably younger than I am now, but they were old to me. They were seemingly having a good time and talking about what they were going to gain by standing up for their rights and what they were after in terms of fair compensation from TWA.
they
it made a significant impression upon me, yes. Prior to that time, I really hadn't thought much about the union. I had paid my dues, and everyone I knew was in some union or another. But that's when it first made an impression upon me that these people were standing up and putting their livelihoods at stake to maintain and to add to their income and their stability and
retirement,
all the things that we think of, and they were willing to risk that employment to do so.
What was the outcome of that strike? Was it successful?
It was successful. I believe it ended up in something like a 5% increase. I remember Lyndon Johnson was president, and he wasn't happy that this was going on because five major carriers in the country had really shut things down economically, and that wasn't something he was for. He was not real happy with it. But we actually concluded with a victory over the airlines at that time.
Outstanding. We're talking to Herb Johnson. He's a dedicated leader in the labor movement in Missouri and has been for many years. He's the past president of the Machinist Union Local Lodge 1650, former treasurer of the Missouri AFL-CIO, and current vice president of the Alliance for Retired Americans. Well, Herb, you stated that as a young man you walked the picket line. How did you progress from the shop floor at TWA to the treasurer with the AFL-CIO? How did this all take place?
Well, I held a couple of positions. I was elected union steward and several committees in the local audit committee and budget committee, and finally a delegate to a number of conventions with our district, with our international, and later I served on the full-time health and safety committee for some 15 years there with the union, and then later became president of the local 1650 for several years, a number of years. Later, I did organizing for the national IAM International Union for a couple of years, and then came back to our facility at TWA and was on the bargaining committee, or the grievance full-time committee that we have there at the base. And then I was had the opportunity to become secretary treasurer of the state AFL-CIO in 1997. And the rest is kind of things you know about, and that is to be there on behalf of working people in the state house, working with legislators, getting them to support our position on legislation for and against. And it was a grand experience, and all of my experience prior to that enabled me to, I think, do a reasonably good job at that.
When you began the job in Jeff City in 1997, the makeup of the legislature was a lot different than what it currently is. How did Jeff City change in your time?
Well, at that time, the Democrats had a majority of 98 to 65 in the House and 20 to 14 in the Senate. Unfortunately, we had passed a constitutional amendment to enact term limits. And term limits absolutely turned Missouri upside down. It's the reason we became a red state. Now, granted, the country in general was moving somewhat to the right politically, but I don't believe Missouri would have ever become the red state it is today if term limits had not happened. As soon as term limits kicked in, we virtually lost all of rural Missouri. I don't think we have a rural representative elected right now in the state of Missouri. The reason is term limits. And I was in opposition to them when they passed, and I would propose that they be eliminated now, even though the Republicans have firm control in both houses. I don't believe it's right for you to have set a mandatory limit of somebody serving in an elective office.
It takes away the vote of the people. The people should have the right to make that decision, and when they feel you're not representing them, they should vote you out. It shouldn't be a law that represents that. All that does is bring forward big money, picks a candidate, funds that, and that person wins. And when that person's term limited out, there's a good possibility that that big money has already selected who they want. Where do you think labor's going to go in Missouri? Where's it going to go?
I don't know where it's going to go, but I know what I think it should do. I think it should do what we did in Jefferson City. We realized when we got ourselves into a minority situation in terms of people supporting labor that we had to start working with both parties and not just be supporting only Democrats. We had to consider that 30 to 40% of our members had always been Republicans, and we had really never paid much attention to that. We didn't have to. So because of necessity, we began working with Republicans. We began sitting down with them and talking to them about what we are about, that we're only about the issues that have to do with collective bargaining in the workplace. There's only about a half a dozen issues that we really are that concerned about. Now, we have members who are concerned with all sorts of issues from abortion to gun control, and they're all over the map on that. Those are not workplace issues. We're concerned with work comp and unemployment. We're concerned with teacher tenure. We're concerned with prevailing wage, issues that bring about a decent wage, fair treatment, and dignity at work. That is what the movement is about. That's what it's always been about. We've done a lot of other things in society, and we've affected social change in our country. But the primary reason that we came about was to deal with the workplace.
Make conditions and wages better for the people who work for a living. That being said, how can we get union members to associate their representatives' voting record and their conditions at work?
All you can do is do what we have tried to do through the years, to my knowledge, and that's one-on-one. You have got to talk to that brother and that sister and explain to them the magic of collective bargaining, that collective bargaining empowers people. It is the only way to raise up from wherever you are economically to one in a position of security for your family. The magic of collective bargaining will eliminate the disparity in wages today that is talked about so much, and do so without a new tax and without a new program. You just simply do labor law reform and let people join and bargain freely in collective bargaining, and you will eradicate poverty. You will eradicate the employer, the income distribution problem that we see today, the equality that is talked about. Yes. I think that's what labor has got to do. I think they should band together under the banner of the AFL-CIO and do that kind of work.
A rising tide lifts all boats, and the bottom up is the way to go. The trickle-down experiment has not worked multiple times. Looking back, what are some of the watershed moments in the Missouri labor movement that you can remember?
Well, 1978 Amendment 23, fight over right to work, the 2018 fight once again over our rights in the workplace, and I think term limits governmentally is the most significant thing I can recall happening in the state of Missouri.
It was a huge game changer.
We need to work with Republicans to the extent we possibly can. It worked in Jefferson City for us, and it will work elsewhere.
Discuss how the media has changed over time when it comes to labor issues.
Well, it's become instant news. You know, when we created the Right to Truth Media Breakfast, for instance, you didn't have social media, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have instant news. People were buying print newspapers. Today, they don't. I think circulation in paper, print paper, newspapers is down all over the country, and this town in Kansas City is no exception. I think the circulation of the Star is down to about 78,000 people, but it's still available on the internet.
And finally, what advice do you have for today's union activists?
All I can say is you have to attend your union members and union functions and relate to one another what the reason for you doing that is. The reason for you doing it is to enable those who bargain for you, collectively bargain for you, to be empowered to the point to where they can get for you the kind of fairness at work you need. Let's face it, without any work, what do you need a union for?
Herb, is there anything else you'd like to add in this interview?
Just the fact that I owe everything I have in this life to the trade union movement and collective bargaining. Without it, I would have nothing. And so I am blessed to have been a member of the Machinist Union now for 55 years, and am blessed to be able to continue now with work on behalf of seniors, including myself, in the Missouri Alliance for Retired Americans. I hope all seniors who hear this program will seek us out and become part of our organization.
How can people find out more about the Alliance for Retired Americans?
Go on the internet to the Missouri Alliance for Retired Americans. We have a website.
Well, thank you, Herb. Thanks for taking the time to come and show us on the show and give us your insight on these important labor issues. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Most times, KKFI moves against the stream, but just saying play KKFI to your smart speaker will bring our stream to you. From the KKFI board, staff, active members, and all of our other volunteers, thank you, thank you, thank you to all of you who donated your time and your financial support during our spring fund drive. There is no KKFI without all of you. That being said, we are several thousand dollars short of our goal for this drive, so we're leaving all the thank you gifts on the redesigned KKFI.org donation page until Friday at midnight. Tote bags, t-shirts, collaborations live tickets, guest DJ certificates, or the combo package. We appreciate your support in whatever way you choose to give it. Please visit the brand new KKFI.org and click the donate button, or check out all the thank you gifts at KKFI.org/thanks.
Oklahoma teachers work a long day, shaping young minds for very little pay. We don't know where the money went, 'cause the textbooks we have still say Bush is president. Oklahoma placed 49th out of 50 states for teacher salary, and maybe we're not dead last. But if not for Mississippi, then that's where we'd be. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature. You better fund, our public schools. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature. When we stand up for ourselves, we stand up for our students. Educators work around the clock. Now is the time to demand some more funds. But if we left it up to Trump, he'd pay you the same, but he'd arm you with guns. And already we've made great strides. They've offered a bill to give us $6,000, but we've been waiting on a raise for years. And we'll push for $10,000 till we have it our way. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature, you better fund our public schools. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature. When we stand up for ourselves, we stand up for our students. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature, you better fund our public schools. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature. When we stand up for ourselves, we stand up for our students.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. That song was Oklahoma's strike song, Fallon's Got to Fix Pumped Up Kicks, written by Melissa Denny. Tonight our guest is Eric Blank, author of The Red State Revolt, a 207-page book that analyzes the teacher uprisings of 2018. The book is a page-turner, and we are lucky to have Eric Blank on the phone. So welcome, Eric, to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. First of all, how did you do this book, Eric? You've covered three different walkouts or strikes in three different areas, roughly happening about the same time. Can you paint us a picture of a timeline of the three states?
Yeah, no, I was on the ground in each one of the big statewide strikes that happened in 2018. So it started in West Virginia in late February, early March. Then really about a month later, it popped off in Oklahoma. And then about another month later, there was Arizona's strike. So the struggles didn't overlap immediately. They kind of came one after another, and that allowed me to go from one strike to another and report on the ground and kind of embed myself with the local organizers.
Okay, and tell us about your background, how you decided to undertake all this.
Yeah, well, I had been a teacher for 8 years in the Bay Area, and I come from a family of labor activists and radicals, and I've been a public education organizer for a long time now. So I really was just excited about the strikes when they started, particularly in West Virginia. I wanted to do whatever I could to help organize in support of them and to help get the word out. And to be honest, I don't have any background in journalism per se, but I knew the editor of Jacobin Magazine, and when West Virginia strike started, I basically just asked him if he would let me go and cover it on the ground, and he was crazy enough to let me do that, and the rest is history, I guess. You know, it really worked out. Because I came at the whole movement more as a partisan than as some sort of presumed detached observer, that allowed me to really kind of win the trust of local organizers, because they saw the truth, which is that I was really, you know, a comrade of theirs and a
Yes, and I do want to say one thing to our listeners, is that the book is well written, and it's a quick read, quick, good, easy read, and kudos to you for that. I want to ask the next question by starting at the end of the book with your comment that perhaps describes your outlook. The quote I want to read is, "Never underestimate the ability of working people to turn the world upside down." So can you explain that?
I think there's a widespread sense of pessimism amongst a lot of people in the country, including working people, about the potential for ordinary people to really organize themselves and make a change. And there's really, I think, a necessity against that narrative. And one of the things that's so exciting about these teacher strikes is that it shows the kind of latent potential of working class people to radically transform society and to make a big difference. You know, these strikes really changed the narrative around public education. They won big victories for working people, not just teachers, but students and communities at large. So the strikes sort of demonstrated in really vivid form the potential of working people and the power that we have, particularly when we withhold our labor. You just don't see that very often, because for the most part, people feel powerless. And so one of the exciting things that happened is the West Virginia strike. When it happened, it sort of overnight for many educators across the country snapped that sense of powerlessness, and it made it clear that you could fight back and win.
Okay, who should read this book? Should fast food workers read the book, auto workers, government workers?
Sure. I mean, I think really any worker should read the book. I'd like, I think it's written at a level that is meant to be pretty accessible, as you mentioned earlier. It's not too inside baseball or too jargony. It's really, I think for folks who are new to the labor movement, there's a lot to learn and to get excited about. But for people who've maybe been in the labor movement for a long time, I think there's also a lot of very interesting lessons about, well, what does a mass strike look like on a statewide level in a right-to-work state these days? What is, you know, the relationship between rank-and-file activists and leadership? What's the role of social media? How do you relate to the union? What's the role of socialists? You know, there's a lot of really rich lessons that can be learned from this experience, whether or not you're, you know, a new reader or you've been on the left for a long time. But I think the lessons are, I hope, generalizable to any one of us who has to sell our labor for a living.
One other thing I liked about your book is your use of quotes from the strikers themselves, especially in the chapter, The Roots of Revolt. Can you give us an overview of what are the roots of this revolt for teachers or education workers? Explain relative deprivation and absolute deprivation.
One of the misnomers, I think, about how some of the mainstream media accounts of the strike portrayed the reason they erupted is that it's a very simplified argument, which is that, well, the strikes happened in places where the pay was lowest. And so it was almost just as if you lower pay enough for teachers or presumably workers, then at a certain point they'll rise up. And it's just not the case that there's this direct correlation between worse pay and resistance. It's really much more complicated because, to be honest, the conditions for teachers have been getting worse for a long time, and a lot of working people in these states actually make far less than teachers, but they're not necessarily rising up. So the absolute deprivation, just the low wages in itself, is not enough to spark something like a mass strike, because people need to have a sense of power. They need to have a sense of confidence that they can fight back. And that's one of the aspects, I think, that explains why the teacher strikes are the first real mass strikes we've seen in 40 years. There's a reason it started in education. And some of the reasons for that is that educators still, as weak as our unions are, still have relatively strong unions, or at least we have unions, unlike a lot of other sectors. Another aspect is that we have a lot of community support. So teachers felt like they could take the risk of going up against employers and striking, because they knew that if they did, they were very likely to be able to win the support of students and the community at large.
Yes, you integrate that very well in your book. It is the importance of the public, the community, and the workers themselves. Well, another reason to read this book is you lay out politics as they exist currently. You introduce the campaign of Bernie Sanders and how he influenced the surge of these actions. Can you explain somewhat about this?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons, and this goes to your prior question of why you're seeing the strikes now, is that, you know, there is a new political moment across the United States where the old mainstream center, both Democrats and Republicans, has really been widely discredited. So the 2016 elections, you know, both with the election of Trump, but then also with the rise of Bernie Sanders, but it kind of gave expression to that, and it also furthered this polarization on the ground. And concretely in West Virginia, the two people that really initiated the strikes, Jay O'Neill and Emily Comer, who are two teachers in Charleston, West Virginia, they first got organized together through the DSA, actually, in the wake of the Bernie Sanders campaign. And, you know, Bernie Sanders won every single county in West Virginia, and he clearly played a role, and a lot of the strike leaders talk about this, in legitimizing working class politics, that, you know, the reason there's all these problems that we're facing in our lives and our communities, our workplaces, is not our fault, contrary to what's been told to us, but it's in fact the fault of the billionaires. And that message really resonated, and the strikes kind of came in their wake. And so a lot of the key organizers in West Virginia and Arizona in particular first got politicized, organized the Bernie Sanders campaign, and they kind of took that same class struggle spirit into their unions and to their workplaces and push in the direction of a strike.
So, yes, in your chapter 2 is called The Power of Strikes. And that is an important chapter in your book, I believe. It resolves the question about the power of strikes. Can you explain how the union movement's turn away from strikes over the last four decades has hindered alliances with labor? Why there is no social strength without labor unions?
The reality is, for the last 40 years, organized labor in the United States has largely abandoned the strike weapon, and that is one of the reasons why we've seen the pretty dramatic decline in union strength and the rise in inequality in society at large. And there's been a lot of attempts to try to find alternative to organized labor as sort of a pivot or a center, you know, point of leverage for fighting back against all of the injustices in society. And there hasn't been an alternative found. And the reason for that is that, you know, working people, we have just a level of power when we organize that no other sector of society has. And, you know, we're the majority. So the power of strikes was really shown in these red state rebellions because, you know, teachers, for instance, when they don't go to work, that sets into motion a social crisis that can't be ignored. Millions of students and parents were affected because they depended on their schools to not just teach their kids in the long term, but, you know, and even in the short term, just have a place where their students could go when they have to go to work and where they could be fed. And in the absence of open schools, you don't really have a functioning city. You don't have a functioning state. But that's true for any industry. It's not just education. And that's one of the exciting things then about these strikes is that it's showing again that there is no real equivalent to the strike as far as a powerful weapon for our side.
I think you called it chaos. It creates chaos within the community, the strike of teachers or public workers. So can you comment on why you think the attacks on public education have gone on so long?
Yeah, well, the reality is that the public education in the United States is the last bastion of the public sector as a whole. So it's understandable that really this is where the right wing has its eyes set for one last big counteroffensive against our rights and the welfare state in general. So, you know, they're talking about potentially billions of dollars in profits. You can get rid of the public education system and move towards charters and then eventually towards a complete full for-profit system. It's a huge amount of money. But not just that, teachers' unions are the strongest unions in the country at this point. And so to privatize and dismantle public education, which has been a policy not just of the Republicans, but really of the Democratic Party as well, if you can do that, that is going to be the best way to undermine and hopefully, you know, in the eyes of the rich, destroy the single most important wing of the labor movement right now. So that's their goal. They've been trying to do it. They've been relatively effective for years, unfortunately. But the tide is turning. Clearly, you know, the strikes have overwhelming popular support in the states where they happen and then nationally. You know, I do think that the ability for the billionaires to move forward their agenda has definitely been checked. And we're starting to see a hopeful reversal where there's talk now of moratoriums on charter schools, moratoriums on the kind of over-testing regimes that have been imposed for so long.
And we're winding up here for our first 18 minutes. Each of these three red state strikes and job actions, and you kind of have almost formula for of things you need to have a successful strike or job action. And it's different for each of these three states. So what I'm asking you now, can we be formulaic about what's needed for strikes? Is there, I was hoping you could give us just a formula, but from reading your book, it seems like there is no formula.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a formula because so much of organizing is context specific. And so because contexts are different, the particularities of the tactics you're going to use are really going to depend state by state and industry by industry. So, yeah, there's no formula, but I do think there's some generalizable lessons. You know, one of them is one of the things that I really try to highlight in the book is that one of the components of the successful strikes in West Virginia and Arizona were what I call and what others have called the militant minority, in which you have this core group of rank and file activists who have experience, who have an orientation towards strikes and kind of class struggle politics, and who are able to push their unions to maybe go further than the traditional leaderships often want to do, because the union officialdom in large part remains oriented towards just lobbying the Democratic Party. And so without these core group of organizers, who often whom were socialists, it would have been very hard for these strikes to have happened or to have succeeded. So that's one aspect.
Okay.
And then the other aspect I think it's really worth highlighting is the importance of raising demands on behalf of working people as a whole. One of the reasons unions have been in decline is that for many people, the perception is that unions are just out for themselves. They're just another special interest group. And one of the inspiring aspects of these strikes is that educators were fighting for demands on behalf of students, for more school funding. They were fighting for anti-racist demands, for environmental demands, like having more green space in schools, and just for basically better schools on behalf of working people as a whole. And so because of that, it made it very hard for the politicians to paint these strikers as just out for themselves.
Okay, well, thank you, Eric Plank, author of Red State Revolt, and we hope to have you on the air again to cover maybe parts of each of those state strikes because they're very interesting.
They divide us by our color, they divide us by our tongue, they divide us men and women, they divide us old and young. But they'll tremble at our voices when they hear these verses sung, for the union makes us strong. Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, journeyman wireman electrician of IBW Local 124. Tonight, I'm going to bring you a story of our struggle, which doesn't have a happy ending, but which well illustrates the tactics used by the boss to divide and conquer. The Amalgamated Meat Cutters, AMC, officially the Amalgamated Meat Cutters and Butcher Workmen of North America, was a labor union that represented retail butchers as well as packing house workers. The AMC was chartered as a member of the AFL in 1897 to bring together seven related local unions in Chicago. The union was strongly committed to the craft unionism model initially and targeted mostly skilled workers for organization, but with time, unskilled workers were also organized. The union had 56 departments, each of which represented a different niche in the meatpacking industry. In fact, this overspecialization, coupled with the intentional hiring of workers who couldn't communicate due to language barriers, were both intentional manipulations for control by their bosses. Pay rates varied between 18 and 50 cents per hour. Workers in a given craft in a city had their own local council, executive board, business agent, and contract. However, solidarity was long a problem, and the union was so divided internally that some members would continue working even while others in the same city were on strike. At first, locals behaved very independently and sought their own terms and conditions with the blessing of the greater union, but in May of 1904, a very short list of demands were developed which most AMC locals took up. They called for the adoption of a pay scale with a minimum wage of 20 cents an hour, which was ultimately reduced to 18 and a half cents, for all unskilled labor. Some similar limited minimum wage demands had already been won for certain skilled workers. This minimum wage led the AMC to begin one of the most notable strikes of the early 20th century in the United States. On July 12, 1904, 18,000 union members in Chicago walked off the job for higher wages, and about 8,000 allied union craft workers joined them. The strike was referred to as a general strike by contemporaries. The union had actually reached agreement on an 18.5 cents an hour minimum wage for unskilled workers on July 6th, but the Employers Association of Chicago broke their word to not discriminate against union members. AFL President Samuel Gompers begged the union not to strike, but the Amalgamated walked out anyway. Gompers subsequently refused to support the strike. More devastating, however, was that two AFL unions, the stationary firemen and the stationary engineers, refused to support the strike either, and their members stayed on the job. The city's ice houses stayed running, and most meat remained frozen and marketable. This hostility and lack of solidarity seriously undercut, pardon the pun, the power of the striking meat cutters. Then the Employers Association chose one of the most devastating cards from their union-busting playbook, stoking race hatred. The Employers Association hired thousands of unemployed African-American workers as scabs. On August 18, 1904, when several black cattle drivers strayed outside the city's main stockyards, chasing cattle, another angry union member surrounded them and pelted the men with stones. Roughly 150 policemen formed a cordon to protect the strikebreakers, and angry union members replied with rocks and gunfire. More than 4,000 union members rioted. The strike ultimately ended in defeat for the union on September 6, 1904. The international union itself may have been broken if not for the intervention of social reformer Jane Addams, who personally met with Armour and company president J. Ogden Armour and helped convince him to offer the union a desultory contract. Upton Sinclair's landmark novel, The Jungle, alludes to the 1904 strike. The union also conducted a major strike from late 1921 through February 1922, which has also been perceived as a failure. Two black strikebreakers were lynched as a result of the strike, Jake Brooks in Oklahoma City in January, and an unnamed injured black meatpacker was kidnapped by the Klan from a Fort Worth hospital and lynched near the stockyards in February. Most of the labor struggles I share here are great victories, but there is also something valuable to be gleaned from great defeats. From the very beginning, the distinction of skilled versus unskilled and race and ethnicity was an intentional barrier imposed by employers to hobble organizing, ultimately resulting in violence and division which crippled the union. While their cause of setting a minimum wage floor for all meat cutter workers was a noble one, their lack of brotherly solidarity with the stationary engineers and firemen was also a hobbling blow to their strike. Ultimately, a lack of solidarity between races and specialties of workers was the fatal flaw. Let's do better today. Hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Have a great evening, everyone.
Now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar.
Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast is this Saturday, June 16th, 8:15 a.m. for breakfast, 9 o'clock a.m. for speakers at Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. Speakers will be Kathy Wolf Moore and Tom Burrows. Has some employers stiffed you on your pay? The Worker Rights Monthly Intake Clinic gives you free legal advice on how to collect. That's Monday, June 17th, 5 to 8 p.m. at El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, also KCK. The Labor Network for Sustainability will hold its third national labor convergence on climate change, June 28th to 30th, Chicago. Go to labor4sustainability.org/convergence. And the KCK Annual Street Blues Festival will be Saturday, June 29th, 1:30 to 11 p.m. at Lavender Circle L Ranch, 3924 North 49th Drive, Kansas City, Kansas. It's on Leavenworth Road, 1 mile west of 635. Tickets are available at kckblues.com. And that's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called Don't Privatize Our Postal Service! ! And we're also going to have Lee Camp on, talking about Democratic candidates. That should be fun. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special, because we're going to have a special with a man who spent a couple of weeks driving immigrants to planes on the border after they got dumped by ICE. And he's got some great stories to tell. And then later on, the Thursday night the local showcase, which Keith is hosting. So stay tuned. Don't move your dial.
Disgrace and standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
The camera.